Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Daniel, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. This is a two-part episode, all within this podcast file, but I'm doing something different. I'm calling it tentatively the exit interview as a feature for Real Jam Radio. And what I'm intending to do here is a 10 to 20 minute in-depth interview with an expert on a specific team around their elimination from the postseason. This one will be with Anthony Slater of The Athletic, going in depth, of course, on the Golden State Warriors. And this one runs longer, and then those will be complements to the rest of the show. And for this episode, that is Jared Dubin talking about the playoffs. So starts out Jared Dubin talking about where everything stands right now. It's been a wild first round, potentially a short-lasting first round. We'll have to see that. Jared and I talk about that, of course. And then after about a half an hour with Jared, then Anthony Slater, I'll intro that part as well. So this episode is brought to you by Prize Picks. Whole episode runs about an hour. Lots of really good stuff in here. And we'll talk about what you guys think about this. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man. It's always a good time.
I figure we have to start with Sixers, Knicks. I mean, we're recording this on Sunday afternoon. We saw that game happen earlier. And what's striking for me is, while this wasn't as remarkable of a late game fail collapse for the Sixers, the Knicks just have a stranglehold in this series, and it doesn't matter how many, if every game is close, if you win 3 out of 4.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there was some element of that to the late game failures of the Sixers.
Sure.
There was a pretty decent stretch where Embiid just didn't touch the ball and was camping out in the corner because Isaiah Hartenstein picking up his fifth foul late in the third, and the Knicks being forced to switch OG Anunoby onto him for the remainder of the game, I think kind of wound up winning the Knicks the game because OG was making Embiid work so hard just to even touch the ball, and there was a pretty significant stretch where he actually didn't get it, and everything was having to go through somebody else. And the job that OG was doing on him, and the job that Precious Achiuwa was doing in space, and the job that Josh Hart was doing as a help defender, and that Miles McBride was doing on Tyrese Maxey, I mean, you put all of that together with whatever Jalen Brunson has been able to find for these last two games. The first two games of the series were legitimately the two worst games I've seen him play for the Knicks, and game one was by far the worst on both ends of the court. And then since then, he has done all season, Brunson just absolutely cracked whatever it is that the Sixers were doing to him, and he has been unbelievable in these last two games. And the combination of those things, unbelievable basketball to watch, too, just in general, in Game 4. To me, that was the best game of the playoffs so far, even beyond Bucks-Pacers Game 3.
Especially because it was a lot of it was tread on the ground of, teams playing well rather than, just a close game. I thought there were lots of Bucks-Pacers that was just frustrating. You know, it was close, but it was frustrating. You know, that sort of a situation. You broke that game down extremely well with Nate on Dunked on Prime. And I think that, for me, part of the fun, and I'm really happy you framed it in this perspective, of Game 4 was, I know there will be a lot of attention paid to Nick Nurse not giving Joel Embiid a break during the second half, and that is a fair way to put it. The other part of that same coin, which deserves just as much, if not more, attention, was that Embiid had to exert more effort per minute during that second half, particularly after Hartenstein picked up his fifth foul, than he had during the rest. So both of those things are really important to mention and to spend a little bit of time on, because yes, Embiid was tired because he was playing a lot, and I would argue too much, and he was tired because they're making him work hard.
Yeah, I mean, the making him work hard part, I think, was an even bigger key than him just being out there. Oh my God, did you just see this technical in the Bucks-Pacers game?
No, I don't have it on. I don't have it on my second screen.
I have it on in the background. Siakam gets a dunk and then, I don't know, looks at Portis and got teed up for it. Literally looked at him for a second. Oh my God. We got to stop doing this, NBA refs. Okay, anyway, yeah. Making him work that hard to touch the ball, It's so big because he's able to exert more energy when he doesn't have to work as hard to get the ball. And it's Hartenstein, I think, had done a pretty decent job of defending him in the first few games of the series, and obviously Mitchell Robinson did an incredible job in game one. But that was all after he got the ball, I thought. There was one play where in game one where Mitchell Robinson made him work really hard, but what OG was doing to him, fronting him, and just I don't know how else to describe it other than to say, make him work incredibly hard to get the ball. And that is something that is connected to, I guess, something that I wrote about last season of making teams waste time on the shot clock just to get the ball up the floor. Making them waste time on the shot clock to get the ball to Embiid and make Embiid waste energy before he touches the ball. The combination of those things, I do think, played a role in the Sixers shooting whatever it was, 30-something percent from the field.
It did. And a related criticism of Nick Nurse is that once the Knicks went to that approach, it becomes more imperative to also have guys on the floor who can throw the kind of pass that you need to get that ball into Joel Embiid. And I've been harping this entire series that Nurse is not playing Nicola Batum enough. And in part, Nicola Batum is better than Tobias Harris, and that is an important consideration. But additionally, he keeps the ball moving, he keeps things going, and there are really only two guys on the Sixers that I trust to make that kind of a pass. One is Kyle Lowry, who is in the starting lineup, and he played 33 minutes in this one. The other one is Nicola Batum. And so Maxey, he's a very good basketball player. He's had some great moments in this series. That's just not what he does. He doesn't have that traditional point guard skill set. He's assembling that, but isn't quite there yet. And so for me, once you understand the tactical battleground that this section of a game is going to be played on, Nick Nurse needs to identify, well, here are the players who give me the best chance. And the other frustration for me with Batum not playing over Harris is that it isn't the sort of traditional trade-off of if you want to go offense, defense, floor spacing versus slashing or something else. Tobias Harris isn't really providing much of value. He did have a couple of rebounds in this one, though. He has been famously terrible at times in this series as a rebounder. And so it's like, well, play your best player who also happens to be specifically better in this exact thing that you need in this exact moment.
Yeah, I think he's also just a flat-out better defender at sure. this point, too. Pretty clearly.
Jalen Brunson sure seems to think so.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I don't think that the Batum on Brunson minutes have gone particularly well, but they've gone better than the Harris on Brunson possessions when they happen, when the Knicks are able to finagle that matchup, which is, to be fair, not all that often. They're not specifically attacking that matchup every trip down the floor or anything, but, Harris as the help defender is providing basically nothing. He's not giving you as much as a rebounder as Batum is. He had 8 rebounds in 34 minutes tonight. Batum had 7 in 21 minutes. It's not like he's doing all that much better for you on that end. And he's not making shots. Granted, Batum didn't make any shots today either, but he's, I think, nominally more of a threat at this point. I don't want to put as much of this on, Nurse's coaching decisions that as we seemingly are, with the... But, the defense that the Knicks played in the second half, and particularly in the fourth quarter, was, oh my God level good. That fourth quarter, I think, was one of the best defensive quarters that I've seen from a team all season. Not just what OG was doing against Embiid, but also what Achiuwa and Hart in particular were doing as help defenders and what McBride was doing at the point of attack. It was incredible stuff.
I believe that the Sixers did not make a field goal in the final 5:04 in the game. There were foul shots and everything else, but that was largely earned. I thought that the Knicks did a fantastic job. We've talked about making them work and executing and doing everything else. And so what, in a way is sad as somebody who enjoys good basketball and who has really enjoyed this series, even with the foul nonsense at the end of game 3 and some of it in game 4, is that the nature of a 3-1 series, which is what this is now, is that I absolutely can see Philadelphia winning games in the series. I think that they have a credible shot in every game where, let's say, the health gods are largely in line with that. However, it is extremely unlikely that Philadelphia will win all three. They, you know, their chances in each game are high, but it's it's the events that all have to happen. And so New York, very overwhelming favorites to win the series, and there's still drama in each game. There's still a lot to do, and that's exactly why it's so important to win every game that's close, because that gives you the margin for error, theoretically, should things go wrong for the Knicks. Not that they necessarily will.
Yeah, I mean, a few things to respond. Like, so even if we give the Sixers like a 60% chance to win each individual game, which is on the higher side,
sure,
that's only what, like a 22% chance to win all three. Like, that's not a significant chance, obviously. So, and that's giving them probably more of a chance to win each individual game than they actually have, considering the way these games have gone. And then you have to consider, there are not two-day breaks between the games anymore. So there's not as much time for Embiid to get healthy between games, which is obviously a pretty significant issue. Now, that's also an issue for the Knicks playing guys, you know, 47 minutes a night. Like,
sure.
But in fairness, Josh Hart is at this point used to that. You know, it's not like Brunson hasn't been banged up for months to begin with. And then you mentioned that, you know, there were free throws for the Sixers in that final stretch. I think a big key was once OG started guarding Embiid, he fouled him like 40 seconds later, and then there was a 12-minute span where Embiid did not get to the free throw line.
Yeah,
so
great point.
That is enormous. And part of the reason that the Knicks obviously were able to play such good defense. And then can we just tip our caps to Kyle Lowry for like one of the A++++++ grifting games in the history of the NBA? Like, my God, the 3-point foul on Brunson in the first half where Brunson is just on the ground and Lowry notices and is just like, okay, I'm going to lean forward because this is
It should not have been a shooting foul, by the way. Like, that was if the player is an impediment and you look down at them before you start your shooting motion, it is not a shooting foul. It is sort of like the guy who has his arm on you the whole time and then you go through. Like, anyway, that's an aside.
And he had the one on OG at the end of the game.
The
again.
Screen foul. And then there was another one. There was another one, too, on a rebounding action where he got a little contact and flew a little bit. And then, you know, I hope that there can be some corrections, though there will always be some element there. I want to...
He's been doing it for 10 years, and there's not been a correction. There's correct. Not going to be
true.
A correction.
That's true. So I want to kind of open up the field. We're going to, you know, this is a shorter conversation. What else is sticking out to you about the playoffs so far?
Phoenix is bad. You know, they'll presumably get the door closed on them later tonight when we're recording this. I thought that Law Murray from The Athletic pointed out something very interesting on Twitter, which is that in game one, the Clippers made 18 threes and they won. In games two and three, they made 18 threes combined and they lost both. And earlier today, like 20 minutes ago in game four, they made 18 threes and they won. So they either need to make 18 threes in a game, or if they don't, they apparently lose.
Yeah, I think that there has been, like, at times, that series to me at times is actually a little simpler than some are thinking. It's the importance of Kawhi Leonard, and yeah, he is there. But it's also the counterpoint of that, like, Dallas at the beginning of game four. As much as the Clippers were making threes, they were 8 out of 11 in the first quarter. Dallas was 0 for 7. The only one they made was a Maxi Kleber 3, which came after the shot clock had expired. And so it doesn't have to be complicated. I haven't all the way worked this out, but I think there's a version of Occam's Razor, which is never attribute to narrative what can be explained by three-point variance. And it's just, there are those circumstances. And, it, you know, our mutual friend Seth Partnow talks about it being a make or miss league, and there's all those components. And I do think, though, that there is an element of this Clippers team that if Kawhi Leonard is straight up not available, it's actually easier for the players to kind of understand what they need to do and what they don't need to do than when he's on the floor but compromised. And it's a difficult thing that franchises have had to navigate, and unfortunately are having to do a whole lot during these playoffs. But that does not mean like the Clippers are a better team without Kawhi Leonard. It might mean that even with the tightened rotation and the pressures that it puts on their depth guys, that it makes the hierarchy more understandable for these players, and so they kind of know what they need.
Yeah, that was something that Nate and I talked about on the podcast the other night too, where like if Kawhi is out there but you can't access the Kawhi part of your offense, which for the most part is like give the ball to Kawhi and let him break down the guy in front of him one on one, then it sort of short circuits a lot of the other things that you need to do offensively, because he's not as often like the safety valve or the outlet guy in pick and rolls or things like that. And particularly in game three, I think, which was the one that Nate and I talked about, was he was not shooting quickly enough off the catch with his jumper to be that kind of outlet to begin with. And then when he was getting the ball, with the exception of those two dunks in the third quarter, it was, you know, not making quick decisions, not particularly being explosive or athletic or anything else. So I do think there is an element, like you said, of players being more locked into what they need to do on each particular possession and throughout the game, because they know he's not going to be out there. And then today, like, you know, you mentioned Dallas started 0-for-7 during that same stretch. The Clippers were 8-for-13 from three. And it's obviously really, really tough to come back from that. The Mavericks did actually come back from
it.
They did. But the, you know, then Paul George makes his shot, and, you know, like, you make just enough threes, like 18 of 29 from three. It's tough.
The other takeaway that I had from game four is, and this is not a new one for me, maybe for some others, is the limitations of Dallas's supporting cast in ways that aren't supposed to be their weaknesses. So this is not like, oh, inconsistent role players are inconsistent at shooting threes. There was a situation late in the game where James Harden, I mean, his overall stats from the fourth quarter, Harden had, I think it was 15. Yeah, he had 15 points on 6 of 8 from the field. James Harden, who has not been the greatest inside the arc player for a lot of this year, was 12 of 17 from the field and 8 of 12 on twos in this game. And that's two major elements. One, inconsistent and I would say often bad late one-on-one defense. And so they were having PJ Washington do it. Washington was just getting torched almost every single play. And then the other one, if you want to say it was rim protection, though Harden was taking a lot of his shots a little further out, like doing that, is that lack of rim protection. So Gafford played 19 minutes. He's still dealing with a back issue. Lively played 8 and had, or played 18 and had some good plays, but wasn't really, he wasn't as present in that, like he's not quite that kind of guy yet. So it was Kleba a lot late. And so if you have Kyrie and you have Luka, then you have there are some specific elements that you need from your other players. You need them to be able to defend, you need them to do all this stuff, and ideally hit open shots. And I was frustrated, though not surprised, that those elements failed for the Mavs as much as the obvious ones did.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Like, you know, you even look at a guy like Exum who hasn't been shooting well. He comes in, misses a couple shots, plays 2 minutes, and is out the rest of the game. Like, Gafford, I think, in 3 of the 4 games has been pretty bad. Yeah, the one good game. Lively, I don't know that you can necessarily play him, you know, 30 minutes in a series like this if he's going to be able to hold up defensively in that length of time. They do seem to trust Kleba more to make the backline rotations, which makes sense. Lively is, what, like 19?
Yeah.
And, like, is literally, like, grieving the death of his mother a couple weeks ago and coming back from an injury. Like, it's a lot to deal with for a rookie, particularly against a team that, you know, for all of its faults, does, like, know what it's doing, at least, because they have so many guys that are so experienced. That's not to say that Lively hasn't played well at times, but I would understand why they trust Kleba more. But then he's not much of a rim protector, and you wind up in the situation, like you said today, where, you know, James Harden goes 8-for-12 on twos, and that's a pretty significant difference.
It is, and unlike most of the other series, I have a lot of questions about where this one goes, and it will go at least six because it's tied 2-2, but each game feels like a true coin flip. And I mean, my skepticism that Kawhi Leonard will play another minute in the series, it kind of holds, and that it's definitely a change. Like, it seems more like now it's like I'm treating him as out until we know he's back. Whereas before it was like, kind of a little bit each direction. And that is terrible for Kawhi personally and for the Clippers organizationally. But it might actually clarify things a little bit for the reasons we talked about before. I want to go back to the Suns, though, because you brought that up. And they have easily been the largest disappointment for me, unless we're talking big picture, key players being hurt. And the Suns do not have some of these disadvantages that all these other teams have been dealing with. Oh, star player being out or surprise everything. I thought, Grayson Allen is dealing with an ankle issue. But relative to everyone else, they're in a relatively good place. And they're just getting run. And there are a series of different failings. There are times where it's like just execution, where it's diligence, where it's effort. And full credit to the Wolves. They have played excellent. They have earned everything that they are getting now. But at the same time, the Suns absolutely are not.
Yeah, I mean, two things can be true at once. The Wolves look incredible, and they are shutting the Suns down offensively. But also, the Suns are not doing, like, a lot of the stuff that worked really well for them against the Wolves in the regular season, just for no apparent reason. Some of it is because some of the things in their offense are being shut off. Like, I think McDaniels on Booker has been absolutely incredible. And then Gobert in space has been, like, shutting off literally everywhere on the court. And you just can't go anywhere without Gobert preventing you from getting there and forcing you to a different spot and somehow also preventing you from getting there. Like, he's been unbelievable. Edwards has been locked in defensively. Like, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, when he's been on the floor, has been absolutely locked in defensively. He's been incredible. But also, like, the Suns, like, kind of look like they don't want to be out there and kind of look like they haven't played basketball together before. And that's, you know, that's something that we've seen from them at times this season, something everybody has harped on over and over. Like, it's not like this is the first time that they've had meltdown games this year, you know? Like, we've seen it from them before. It just happens to be happening multiple games in a row against the same team.
And the way that they've been outplayed and outclassed in this series is extremely discouraging, thinking about what the Suns can be moving forward, because their window isn't that big. That's when you trade for Kevin Durant and then you trade for Bradley Beal shortly thereafter. Like, you're committing to a narrower window, and they don't have the flexibility, especially with the collective bargaining agreement, second apron restrictions, to significantly add to this talent. They could reshuffle it a little bit, but not necessarily add to it. And so they are going to have to take stock, and that's not only the coach, which apparently, according to Woj, there will at least be some discussion on Frank Vogel. It's also the players involved. And the part of the theory of this Suns team was, okay, we're going to have three offensive players so good that nobody can really handle all three of them. And part of it may be the fate of running into Minnesota, who has a lot of good defensive players, but that hasn't generated A, as many good shots as it should, or B, a consistently viable offense like it should all season. Like, that's not just a new thing. And Beal's injury was a part of it, but honestly, it was mostly true overall.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it obviously was that they didn't play together a lot. And the minutes that they did share the court during the regular season, they had the equivalent of what would have been the best offense in the league. There obviously were times where they played together that things did not look that way, particularly in fourth quarters, which were an issue for them throughout the entire season. But the thing to me, like you mentioned, and this is something I talked about with Nate too, like, the whole theory of the team was those guys are going to be good enough, that they're going to score enough, that nothing else is going to matter. That, and it needed to be that way. That was the only way
it would work.
Right. That was the only way the team would be viable. And not only has that not been the case, but their offense has been like a spectacular failure throughout this series. So it's like, you know, it's one thing if they get held a little bit below what they were doing in the regular season. You know, they get like, you know, 112, 115 offensive rating, something like that. Like, it has been a disaster for them offensively throughout this series. And that just, like, it's not only something that they can't have. It's like, that wasn't the expectation, you know? Like, it's the exact opposite of what the theory of the team was. And, you know, you can't trade Beal, obviously. He's got a no-trade clause. I don't know necessarily if you want to trade Durant. Like, your team becomes defensively totally unviable if he's not on it, because he's the only guy on the team that is, you know, defending on both the perimeter and at the rim. You know, I think Jusuf Nurkić was a little bit better than expected defensively this season, but he's not, like, a defensive anchor. You obviously don't want to trade Booker, and then you're left with, like, okay, what can we get for Grayson Allen or, you know, Royce O'Neal or Eric Gordon? And I'm not even sure which of those guys is under contract next season yet, but, you know, Nasir Little, like, what are you getting for any of these guys? You can't sign buyout guys. You can't use the full mid-level. You can't make lopsided trades. Like, this was the whole reason that, despite Beal probably being the best player that you could get in exchange for Chris Paul's contract last offseason, this was the entire reason that people had, like, a conceptual reason to be against that Beal trade, because it locked you in essentially to whatever you did last summer, and that's it.
Yes, and they will now have to deal with that moving forward. As we're recording this, the Suns have the third worst offensive rating on cleaning the glass of any team that made the playoffs. The Warriors don't count because they got eliminated in the play-in. New Orleans and Cleveland are the only ones that are worse so far. And last question I wanted to ask you, and I'm not trying to get a prediction for the playoffs and where things go from here. Just what team or teams do you think have played and looked the best so far?
Minnesota, without question. Like, that's, I think that they've looked so far like probably the best team in the playoffs. I'm not sure I can.
Especially because they're playing an opponent that is pretty much whole. Like, the OKC has been ridiculous, but OKC is playing the Pels without Zion.
Zion, with Ingram compromised, like, not that Ingram was necessarily going to be that much of a threat to them to begin with. They can kind of shut his water off with Lu Dort, which they've largely done throughout the series, but it's still not the best version of the team that they're playing.
I agree. And so yeah, Minnesota has played the best. Now, that does not mean I think that they're the most likely champion, or even that I'm going to pick them to win in the next round, because, oh, you know, they're probably playing the reigning defending champions in the next round. But they've been awesome, and they can hang their hat on this series no matter what happens next.
Yeah, that brings me to a good point, actually, which, you know, you mentioned, like, that does Minnesota looking this good doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to, you know, win the title or even win the next round. A lot of people tend to forget that each playoff series is like its own organism, and how Minnesota plays against Phoenix does not have all that much, if anything, to do with how the Wolves will play against the Nuggets. Like, completely different teams, completely different matchups. Like, it has, like, you gotta almost disregard everything that happened in the previous series when you're trying to analyze the next one. That's something that I think a lot of people tend to struggle with around this time of year. It's like, oh, you know, how good Minnesota looked in round one. Look how much Denver struggled with the Lakers in round two. Like, it matters to some degree, but not nearly as much as people tend to think. Well, that said, the Nuggets have only held a lead for 21.5% of the running time so far of this series against the Lakers, the record for any team since 1997, which is as far as play-by-play data goes back. The record for any team that won the series is 22.5%, so like a full percentage point higher than where the Nuggets are at now. That was by the 2002 Lakers against the Spurs. And, of course, the 2002 Lakers went on to win the finals anyway. But
It's a great
stat.
They
have not played with the lead for very much of this series at all.
It's striking. And I'm not reading too much into that. And if we were ever going to get disabused of the notion that what immediately preceded a series mattered, it is somebody like me using that Suns win over the Wolves on the last day of the regular season as an important index point for their series and then getting completely demolished by that. So maybe we can go the right direction moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I fell into that too. I took that game combined with the early season game that, you know, I know was on a back-to-back, and the night after the Draymond and Rudy Gobert, whatever the hell that was. But I took those two games, and I was like, these are literally Minnesota's two worst defensive games of the season. They attacked them in very similar ways. A lot of, like, double screen and re-screen action and just getting to the spots on the floor that generally Minnesota wants to force you to, and making shots and making good decisions from those spots. And I was like, all right, you know, this is the kind of matchup that is not particularly good for Minnesota and is great for Phoenix. And I picked the Suns in the series, and it just has not mattered on any level at all.
Yeah. We learned these lessons. Hopefully we remember them for next year, but the ride will be fun all the way. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, man.
Thanks again so much to Jared Dubin for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at Last Night in Basketball. You can also listen to him break down Friday's action more in depth for Dunked On Prime. I had a wedding to attend, so he filled in for me and did a great job. And if you haven't already, lastnightinbasketball.com, and then he has a Substack that's really good, and of course you can follow Jared on social media as well. Lots more to discuss, but first a message from Prize Picks. NBA playoffs are obviously right on the horizon. You can get in on the playoff action and win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks as you and the world's best players take the game to a new level during basketball's postseason. And you can now win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks with as little as 4 correct picks. You can turn $10 into $1,000 with basketball, hockey, and college basketball entries today on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy app. I really like that Prize Picks is player specific to my intuition. I think that works a little bit better, and it's very straightforward. You find the player projection that you find interesting, and then you just go more or less on that number, and that's easy to connect with, and of course it'll make the playoffs more fun, though they're plenty of fun anyway. And the way that you can check out Prize Picks is you download their app today, and then you use the code CLNS. Because that gets you a first deposit match up to $100. It also tells Prize Picks that you came from us. So download the Prize Pick app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. And now it's time to debut a new feature for Real GM Radio, and that is what I'm calling the exit interview. It is an in-depth, team-specific breakdown with an expert on that franchise, and Anthony Slater of The Athletic is a perfect first guest for this. He knows the Warriors inside and out, and these are always intended to be a mixture of what happened, why this team got eliminated, and where things are going from here. And while Anthony Slater and I talked for 30 minutes, most of these will be in the 10 to 20 minute range, but there's so much to discuss with the Warriors, their elimination, ownership's willingness to spend, Klay Thompson's future, the development of the young players. And so we went a little bit long, we had the time, but I absolutely love the conversation. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yes, sir.
So I want to start this with actually your interpretation of how the Warriors season overall went in terms of, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to take it in terms of the young guys and the not making the playoffs formally, but how did you see it being on the ground every day?
I think the first half was a disaster, but it was a disaster that they kind of needed to go through to transition. A little bit where, you know, like Kevon Looney's deep slump meant Trayce Jackson-Davis got a promotion. Andrew Wiggins and Klay Thompson's slumps meant Brandon Pajemski got a promotion. You know, Moses Moody still is sitting there hand out waiting for a promotion that he seems like he's never going to get. But, you know, you could kind of feel them transitioning towards the younger layer of the roster, which I think was needed, like, in the long term. I think the second half of the season, what was it, I think a 27-12 finish. To me, they looked like the fifth or sixth best team in the conference for the last couple months, right around that range. And I think it's fair to believe, you know, if you restarted the season now with what they know, or, you know, you started the playoffs now, I think they're like kind of mid-playoff-y type team, maybe a sixth seed. But because of how far they fell behind because of what happened with the Draymond Green suspensions. They were eliminated as the 10th seed, and they kind of have to stare in the mirror and say, hey, we were the 10th seed. We can't spend $400 million on a non-playoff team. But I do think there is a bit of an internal belief that they're not the 10th best team in the conference. They're maybe the 5th or 6th best team in the conference. But, you know, is that worth spending $400 million for? I probably don't think so.
Yeah, and that leads me to the other big question, which is, do you feel, from what you know, that the key decision makers here, I'll describe that as Joe Lacob and Mike Dunleavy, is your instinct that they assess this season similarly to you, or do you think they maybe feel differently?
I think they feel similarly. I think there's frustration that they kicked a bunch of games away, and then obviously, like, the Draymond thing looms. Like, they just, and, you know, it's they can just go into next season with a prayer that he won't, you know, get in the league's crosshairs again. Because, like, there's a chance that derails their next season. But, yeah, I think that is the belief that at this point, this core with this supporting cast is decent. They're a playoff team. I think they'd go into next season. Let's say they only tweaked around the edges. I think they would go into next season believing, you know, this team can get a playoff spot. But Joe Lake, that's not how Joe Lake, you know, operates his business. He's like, I want to spend crazy to win a championship and go into the season believing a championship is possible. And I don't think without an overhaul, or, you know, overhaul is probably too strong, but without one player that we believe is like at or near Steph Curry's level, right? Like a number two next to Steph Curry. I don't think there's can be internal belief that, like, this core is legitimately going to win a title again. And I just don't know where and how you necessarily get that, but the NBA can surprise at times.
And that's what makes the Warriors situation so compelling, is that in many ways, the decisions have to come this offseason, and that's just due to the timing. I mean, Wiggins, Draymond, Steph Curry, those guys are under contract for multiple years beyond this year. But then you have not only Klay Thompson, who's hitting unrestricted free agency, but also the decision with Chris Paul. And so to walk people through it just very briefly, Chris Paul has $30 million that he could potentially be paid, or it's non-guaranteed. You can just waive it off entirely. And since it is a non-guarantee rather than a team option, it's trickier to theoretically re-sign him should that be something that they want to do. So we're going to get indications pretty early into, it's probably going to be July rather than June, though we'll get the Chris Paul decision in June, of what Joe Lacob, what Mike Dunleavy are seeing with this team.
Yeah, you know, you could get the Klay Thompson decision in June, too. It was pointed out to me from somebody that I'll just say is involved in the process that, you know, remember Harrison Barnes, what date did he re-sign?
Oh, yeah, I think that it was late June, yeah, and Vucevic did as well.
Yeah, so, like, Klay Thompson could resign tomorrow, right? I mean, you're the cap expert, but like, he could just resign at any point. Extend, I guess we would call it. But, so, you know, I mean, we all know how the league works. I do think that if Klay Thompson's going to come back, it's possible it does come down early. I think the Chris Paul decision, the Chris Paul contract vehicle, we'll call it, that can, you know, go get salary elsewhere matters here because they're ducking the second apron. There's even talk of ducking the tax. From what I understand, you know, there is a deal out there potentially that Klay Thompson would take that could keep them under the tax, but that would mean basically you're slashing Chris Paul's salary and getting absolutely nothing in return. So the one thing the Warriors do have that in past seasons, off seasons, they haven't necessarily had is time, right? You know, they're sorting through these decisions in late April instead of, you know, mid-May or even June in way past years. So I do think that helps them, but, you know, Klay Thompson has, you know, an ego involved here. Klay Thompson has some pride involved here. He's going to want to know that he's an early priority and, like, priority A. And the way these things work, I just think that, like you said, I think we're going to know early because I think if the Warriors start, you know, sniffing around elsewhere and doing all this, then I think they become in danger of losing Klay. And then that completely changes kind of their offense.
Yeah, there are a number of different variables in play that are fascinating. One of them is just how interested are other teams? And of course, this was a part of the Draymond Green story a year ago as well, is just how motivated are other teams in play? And there certainly are some where Klay Thompson makes sense. And I've been very vocal this year about his downgrade on defense, that since he can't be on ball anymore, it changes what he can do, but he's still a very good shooter, and if you could ever convince him to take fewer twos, that could work out well. And I've heard Orlando brought up, but there are so many teams that could use a player who doesn't need the ball in his hands a lot, who defenses care about, and who, yes, this is good. Klay Thompson's going to be his age 34 season basketball reference next year, but his game should age, you know, it should age reasonably well relative to where he is now, not relative to where he was pre-injury. injuries or anything like that. And so you have those two things where it's like, how much are the Warriors willing to pay? What are they thinking? And then what are other teams throwing out there? And the you brought up Harrison Barnes before. I think that one of the fascinating examples here, you brought up doing the work early, is what happened with the power forwards last year. So it looked like everyone kind of moved right before July because they got this understanding of where things were going. So, like, Kuzma ended up re-signing. Jeremy Grant ended up re-signing. Harrison Barnes went back because the Kings maybe couldn't get either of those guys. And so it could, you know, we know everyone's talking. It's not really going to be a surprise. It's not like, oh, it's June 30th. All of a sudden, like, you get three calls out of the blue from these teams and you haven't heard anything from them at all. And for the Warriors, you're kind of going through all those things at once. And then the other part of this, which is harder to assess right now, is you brought up the let's call it the Chris Paul salary slot. And, I mean, the Warriors have done this successfully with D'Angelo Russell, KD slash D'Angelo Russell slash Andrew Wiggins a few years ago. Is Mike Dunleavy assessing, well, what can we do with that? What does that become? Because in many ways, that is actually the bigger variable in terms of the spending level for the Warriors. Because, like you, I think that if there were a path to getting a top 40, a top 50 player in the league, using that and, of course, significant other assets, you'd have to use picks and young players and everything else, I think they would seriously consider it. And if you could get a top 20, well, of course. But is that possible? Because if it's not, then I'm of the mind that they could just be like, well, let's hope that that top 50 player comes internally, that it's Kuminga or somebody else, and then we can avoid maybe avoid the tax entirely.
Yeah, and I think what's what matters here is like Chris Paul's like agreement within this, right? Because you know, he not only is he very vocal and powerful within the league, but his $30 million it guarantees, I believe, on June 28th, if I have it right.
Which that's right. That's right.
Referenced earlier. But I do think if he knows that it might get traded with like either a full guarantee or a partial guarantee, which, by the way, that's the flexibility of it. You can guarantee any portion of it,
right?
You know, to kind of salary match. That's appealing to him because I'm not, you know, if he's a free agent, I don't know what you think, but I mean, maybe a mid-level, but he's not getting $30 million, right? So, like, I do think that he'll probably play ball in this process just for financial purposes, right? So, you know, that'll help. But, yeah, I think we are going to get indications early, and that will probably, you know, signal to Klay Thompson and Klay Thompson's people, like, you know, where things are going with him.
Let's game out a little bit with that Chris Paul thing. I've described this before as the walking trade exception because the human trade exception seems dehumanizing in a weird way. If you were assessing this Warriors team and they could acquire a player roughly in that salary range, what attributes would you be looking for in that player?
Off the dribble scoring, maybe somebody like Jordan Poole. No, I'm just kidding. Well, you know, I say I'm kidding. If you give me 2022, you know, playoffs Jordan Poole, 2022 season Jordan Poole, right? Like, you know, that's an undertold part of that title, I think, because of what's kind of happened to his career since. But, like, remember just, like, the dynamic scoring that he brought that was just such a revelation to you know, for staff, for their entire team, which, you know, kind of, I guess, faded a little bit deeper the playoffs went. You know, he was sitting only at, like, about 20 minutes per game in that Boston series. But you go back, watch game 6 of the NBA Finals that they close out in Boston, it's like, there's a 21-0 run that Poole scores like 10 of the points, has a couple assists. Like, he's great. And I'm not saying to just redo the trade from last summer and bring Jordan Poole back, but like, they need like dynamic scoring. Like, Steph Curry needs like a partner in crime in the scoring department. And I just think ideally that would be like a bigger wing that can defend too, right? You know,
sure.
They kicked the tires on Pascal Siakam. I think that's well known. Siakam looks great right now in that Pacers series. I think part of the hesitancy from the Warriors side was like Pascal Siakam's desires, and you know, market would tell you he's probably going to get at least $40 million a year. The Pacers seem willing to give him that. He seemed more interested in the Pacers long term, but you know, and who knows how he'll end up towards 30? Might already be 30. So you probably would want a younger version of that, but like, you can't be that picky. That's the thing with the Warriors. Like, you could say no to Siakam, but now in retrospect, you're like, should you have? Because I don't know how many options there are out there.
It's a great point. And I mean, the amount of players who are gettable, because the Warriors have to do this via trade. They don't have a way to sign. I mean, maybe if they actually got all the way under the tax, they could do a sign trade, but it would be very logistically difficult for them. And something else that Golden State needs more now than they have previously is a point of attack defender, because now Klay Thompson isn't really that guy anymore. Wiggins can do it against the bigger guys. Like, I thought Wiggins did a great job against Luka in one of their games against the Mavs late in the season. But most lead creators are not Luka. You know, they're differently sized, they're smaller, they're faster. And so sometimes that does dovetail with somebody who can score, who can create, but those guys are often hard to find as well. And so the idea of, you know, because like you ideally want somebody, you know, there were times in various years where Gary Payton II was really useful for them, but this Warriors team probably needs a little more creation, needs somebody who can do a little, who has a little bit more juice. And they could potentially, because the beauty of a single player is that you could break that into multiple things, but who is a logical trade partner, who's interested, and all that type of stuff. So, like, I would say those are the two big ones for me. Point of attack defense and, like you, scoring creation, just somebody else, and that can take some of the weight off of Curry, and also take a lot of the weight in the non-Curry minutes, which have been a challenge at various moments in time, basically, for the last decade.
Which were actually decent this year with Chris Paul.
Right.
I don't think Chris Paul is coming back necessarily to the Warriors. So the other thing I'd say, and they've talked about this, postseason, is like there is a level of internal growth needed, regardless of the maneuvers they make this offseason. They need Kuminga to be better next season, particularly, I think, on the defensive end, because he has some really intriguing individual defensive tools. And there's been times, even back to his rookie year, where, you know, if they give him one particular assignment, hey, you're playing Utah, like, go lock up Jordan Clarkson. Don't worry about anything else. Just, like, stop him in one-on-one situations. He's shown some real stuff laterally, you know, as a shot blocker. But I would say he took a step back this season defensively, not only on the team side, but even the individual side. And part of that is, you know, when young guys start scoring more, they start trying maybe less, using a little bit less energy on the defensive end. So him getting better on that end will be big next season. Moses Moody, I think is ready. I think everybody believes is ready to step into a bigger role. I think he has not been he's been better offensively and maybe a little bit worse defensively over the course of time. But they had a game this season when Wiggins missed that they put him on Jalen Brunson in New York. He did really good work that night on Jalen Brunson. Like, that was the story of postgame. So I think they're on certain matchups. Moses Moody in a bigger role could show some growth. They put Pajemski on guys. You know, he's scrappy. Steve Kerr compares him to Austin Reeves. I think he's at times limited, especially against bigger scores, but he'll take charges and he's smart. So I think there are areas that, you know, defensively, individually, that they can just get better by just getting older.
That's true. And it's funny because time helps some Warriors and hurts a lot of Warriors, just depending on where you are in the pecking order. And that, you know, the old two timelines and all those other discussions in the past. And Kuminga is at times an under-discussed key of this Warriors offseason in a couple of different ways. One part of it is, if you see him as a key piece of moving forward, then in an ideal world, you're thinking about his strengths and weaknesses as a part of identifying the remaining pieces. And so that's, what do you want him to do defensively? What do you want him to do offensively? And he's had some growth. I think his drive game got a lot more confident. I think that the Warriors need to do, at times, a better job incorporating that. Like, there are times where his fit within their offense felt awkward. But then the other part of that is Jonathan Kuminga is going to be extension eligible. And that is no guarantee that a deal will get done. But that also helps paint the financial picture. And typically, not always, the rookie scale extensions like Jonathan Kuminga's, they can happen as early as the beginning of the offseason, but a lot of times they come a little bit later. So it may be a sequencing thing where, like, we have an answer on Clay and the Chris Paul salary slot, and then later get an answer on Kuminga. But the combination of his importance on the floor and then his importance financially to their salary cap sheet makes him, like, a really big part of this offseason.
He's extension eligible? I didn't know that. No, the only reason I joke and say that is, I don't know if you saw, but in his exit interview, I asked him about his extension eligibility, and he's like, oh, wow, really? Huh, hadn't thought of it. I'm like, really? You know, this like $100 million decision that's coming down this summer. And I do think that's the ballpark we're talking, right? To realistically get his, you know, side to even listen, like, would be, you know, $100 million long-term deal. And I do think the Jordan Poole example, or, you know, their history with extending Poole early might make them a little bit more hesitant to go big as early as they did. I could see it's something that does go into restricted free agency. But that's always dangerous, and that, you know, kind of sets the table for the season ahead where you know, a guy's playing for a contract at times a little bit more than feeling settled. But, you know, as far as the timing of it, which you mentioned, I really get the sense that that's going to be more of a late September, October decision, and that they're a lot more focused on rebuilding the roster before they even get to, you know, the idea of how much money it'll take to keep Jonathan Kuminga around long term. Because part of his appeal, you know, even, you know, potentially in a trade this summer, right, would be, you know, if he is, you know, his next team can get him at a lower salary and then decide on his.
Yeah, and can also assess. And so this has been, yeah. I mean, even going back to, I mean, the James Harden going from OKC to Houston trade was a different animal because Harden, you know, Harden was a different player and Daryl Morey believed in his potential. But part of the appeal there was that you can negotiate that extension yourselves. That wasn't done with OKC. Houston did that themselves. And so with Kuminga, that could be there. And it's important to bring up that possibility of him in a trade. I'm really happy that you did, is that we brought up the idea that the Warriors need to upgrade, and Kuminga could be a very important part of that, especially since the Warriors are out.
The piece, right? I mean, like,
presumably.
To me, he's more valuable than a first rounder. He's more valuable than Moody, than Pajemski, than Trace Jackson Davis, which, by the way, those guys have value too. But to me, like, if you're another team that's really given a high level player, like, Kuminga is like asset one that you're asking for, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's really fair. And I mean, and there could be some intrigue depending on what teams you're talking about. The Warriors going really deep with their first round picks, because even 2030, which they have owed to the Wizards, that's top 20 protected. They could trade inside that protection and not run into any Stepien rule problems or anything like that. So maybe you could get somebody interested there, but Kuminga is a talented young player. And generally speaking, if what the Warriors end up prioritizing, which is a question, is somebody who's more established, then sometimes trading, like I call basketball middle age, but, you know, trading somebody who's for somebody who's like 28, maybe that team is more interested in someone Kuminga's kind of age and skill set than they are in a pick that'll convey at some point in the future, even if it has some juicy upside potential.
Yeah, the other thing I should say within this is, like, there's still a lot of people in that building very high on Jonathan Kuminga. He
Absolutely.
Made a significant leap this season and did a lot of things, I think, offensively that, like, worked within the Warriors. Like, he's getting quicker with his decision-making, with his quick passes, with his recognition. I can remember several times this season he's pointing at his teammates like, hey, go down screen for Clay. He's coming out. You know, like, he's kind of getting more ingrained in, like, the Warriors style, number one. Number two, like, you know, the front office drafted him and has – you know, desired his development, you know, probably quicker than maybe the coaching staff has over time. And also, I mean, look, we know ownership, Joe Lacob has long been very high on Jonathan Kuminga. And I do think, you know, there's a desire to get something out of this three lottery pick two timeline, whatever you want to call it, right? Like, to give up on the guy. And I don't want to say give up, because obviously if you use him in a trade, you get a high level of value. But, you know, I think it would be hard to part with.
It's going to be a high bar. And the last kind of big thing I wanted to discuss briefly with you is, as I've been assessing these Warriors young guys, and of course, both of us are geographically close to this team, you cover them daily, I'm around a fair amount, is I've been thinking a little bit about the long term. And I'm broadly interested, I'm somewhat high on their young guys. The overall collection of Kuminga, Moody, Pajemski, Jackson Davis, like, I think they're all NBA caliber players. They could end up all being starting caliber. We'll get more time on that when they get a little bit older. But the thing that the Warriors really, really don't have in the pipeline is somebody who can be a high-level creator after Stephen Curry. And in an ideal world, first of all, that was one of the ideas with Jordan Poole. And it's because Stephen Curry is 35, and he's still playing at a relatively high level. But it's the biggest flaw in the idea of never dipping is if the Warriors don't have that player, we know how foundational that is to success at really any level, however we're defining it in the NBA, is that if you can't generate those kinds of shots, then your offense isn't going to be very good. And I wonder, you brought up before about the need for creation, if they try to dovetail that in a way that they've rejected at other points in time. I criticized, you know, I wanted the Warriors to draft LaMelo all those years ago for this exact reason, though things worked out differently then. But I don't, but you could say like, oh, that should happen later, but it's also like Steph Curry's 35, and the more you start to commit to a group, the harder it gets to bring in somebody like that.
Yeah, and, you know, if they don't add somebody with that potential this summer, then it's got to be Kuminga, you know. They kind of were trying to get there this season. There's even been times, I remember Draymond Green came back, they were playing well, and in Utah post-game, he basically said, hey, you know, my suspension kind of led to Jonathan Kuminga leaping to, like, number two on the offensive, you know, pecking order. And, you know, I think varying people would have varying beliefs of, like, you know, what Kuminga's long-term offensive upside is. Steve Kerr has talked about him being become maybe a, you know, a better natural creator to some of, like, his teammates. He is probably a better passer than people realize, but, you know, comes in a little bit of stiffer form at times. He's not feared out to three. He'll take the three. He honestly probably makes it at a pretty, you know, 30, we're talking 35, 37%, but he doesn't stretch the floor. I don't mind his mid-ranger, but, you know, you're not necessarily, you know, if you're just looking at straight efficiency numbers, I don't know that that's spooking a defense at this point. But to your overall point, like, if the second creator isn't added this summer, I think you need to go into next season with the strong belief that Jonathan Kuminga, like, you're giving him the ball and, like, trying to make him the second creator, because I think that is, of the young guys, the guy on the roster, that you could at least see a path there if he really grows.
I hadn't fully processed that, but I think you're right. If it is somebody internally, that's the clearest way that it can happen. And it is a big decision that this group is going to have to make. And it's more than just like, oh, you get a guy in the second round who could potentially be that guy. Like, that the history of it is usually that those guys don't work out super well. They can, but to bet on that or anything like that, depending on where the team goes move forward. And these young guys are part of the challenge of Kuminga's development and some of these other guys taking a little bit longer, is that, like, Kuminga and Moody are going to be on their next contracts in 2025. Like, we're one season away from that. We don't know what they're going to get paid or anything like that, or even if they're going to be on the Warriors. And then Podziemski and Trayce Jackson-Davis, they're further down the line, but it is the same general conceit. The last question I wanted to ask you, and I'm not going to ask for percentages or anything like that, is just, do you think it is more likely than not, or less likely than half, that Klay Thompson is a Golden State Warrior next year?
51% coming back because of nostalgic reasons. I think it's going to be a thorny negotiation, would be my guess. And I could see him in another jersey, which I think would, you know, I think that surprised a lot of people. When I go around the league and you know, I get asked in arenas, or like the topic comes up, usually it's somebody coming up to me like, he's coming back, right? Like, he's not leaving, right? And you're just like, I think it might happen. But I also know that there's an actual time where a decision will need to be made and conversations will be had within all the people that matter, the legacy people within this organization. And I find it that it might be difficult for him and for them to split up just because of those reasons. So that's why I'll say 51% I think coming back. Did I dodge that question well enough?
I think you did well. I thought you were going to be even more vague and just say more likely than not or something like that. So you dodged less than I expected you to. And then the other, like, for me, the other key question with Clay, and like we brought up the timing, is does another team make him their priority? And I've brought up the phrase a lot that restricted free agency is all about falling in love, but I think it's the same for Klay Thompson, where if I'll just throw out some teams, if Detroit or OKC or Orlando says, you're our guy, you're the thing that we want, well, that puts a lot more heat on the Warriors. That then it's like, well, here's what they're doing. Maybe it's even like, here's the number, years and dollars that they're offering. Or Philly, theoretically, there are other teams that could do it. But I'm not sure any of them are falling all over themselves. Like, maybe they're looking for somebody younger, they're looking for somebody different. And then you end up, you know, it's still June, but you end up being like, well, the Warriors do want me back and we can figure something out. So, like, I think he's back, but I, like you, I'm less confident than the average, like, the general consensus that I seem to be hearing around the team, like, of more like fans rather than internally or anything like that.
By the way, you know, the situation you laid out, I mean, this is their last summer with Draymond Green, right? You know, it, like, there was a thought, well, where's his market? Well, you know, Memphis wanted him. Okay, mm-hmm. Like that's become clear, and there's a reason he got 4 years, $100 million, with including a clear option on the backside. That wasn't because, you know, the Warriors just felt generous and wanted to give up. Like, you know, there was like, you know, a fear of him leaving, and there was a suitor for him to potentially go to, and potentially multiple. So, you know, we'll see. But I do think, Klay Thompson still, I think, was third or fourth in the league in made threes this season, was first the season before. He still has a competitive streak that I think at least makes him a good team defender. You know, you could throw him with some young guys. You know, obviously Orlando is the team we talked about and believe, like, you know, you can hide his lack of maybe, you know, prime perimeter defense that he doesn't have anymore with, like, you know, the Jonathan Isaacs of the world, the length. And, like, he'll still, like, he's not going to be, completely unusable defensively. And he's just going to bring a brand and a level of just, legitimacy, I think, potentially to a young core. So I actually think he's going to have maybe a little bit better.
Yeah, it's going to be absolutely fascinating to watch. Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, sir.
Thanks again to Anthony Slater for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic, and you absolutely should. You can also follow him on social media and wherever he does appear in podcast appearances. He's absolutely fantastic, so plugged in with this franchise. And of course, thanks again to Jared Dubin for coming on for the first half, lastnightinbasketball.com. And let me know what you think of the exit interview. I do intend to do a series of them this offseason. And part of the philosophy for me is that it is a more natural complement to some of my other work. Nate and I are doing game-by-game breakdowns for Dunked On, so I don't feel like Real GM Radio needs to use that space, need to do that with content, even though there are plenty of other great people that I can talk with about that. It's just too redundant. And so trying to do these little subject matter expert things to piece it together. And I think it's a good idea. I'm excited about it. I loved the conversation with Slater. And we'll talk about that. Actually, I'll say the feedback part now. DannyLaRueMBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it, especially in this sort of a case. And I'm not going to do every team. I'm just going to do some, the ones that are most interesting, the ones that I have a guest that I think can really tap into the meat of the decisions and the analysis of what just happened. And so that'll be great. If you want to support Real GM Radio, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choosing. You can subscribe, download every episode, particularly great for Real GM because it's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. And you can also help us out by checking out our sponsors. Prize Picks, you download the Prize Picks app, use the CLNS promo code for that awesome first deposit match. And of course, it also tells them that you came from us. So hopefully they will keep advertising on this fair podcast. You can also check out my other work, written work at The Athletic. Should have a piece coming out this week on the Timberwolves. It just needs to go through editorial. That's pretty fun. And then Dunked On Prime, of course, Nate and I going in depth basically every night on the games that happened. And we'll be getting into offseason previews and draft work and everything else like that coming up in the near term. And then we're doing a lot on Playback. Playback.com/NateDuncanNBA, I believe, is the handle there. And we do live calls where you can watch the game. Really, really cool stuff there. And we're trying to do some simulcasts on YouTube too, so you can check that out. And I already gave you the feedback information, so you can consider that. And we'll, as we start to get eliminations, those will filter in and be a part of the show along with more big picture things and everything else and lots of fun discussions. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.